Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View radio show. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.cleanenergyview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@cleanenergyview.com. Today, my guest is Tom Drillette, and we're going to be discussing Fukushima's history, recovery, and future. The Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster consisted of a series of equipment failures, nuclear meltdowns, and releases of radioactive materials at the Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant following the earthquake and tsunami back on March 11th of 2011. It is the largest nuclear disaster since the Chernobyl disaster that occurred in 1986. On today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the show Thomas Drillette, who is a nuclear energy expert, and he's also the president of Drillette and Associates Energy Services. And he recently visited Fukushima and was also at the site shortly after the disaster occurred to assist with the recovery process. Subsequently, he's also been to Chernobyl and is a highly sought-after speaker on the subject of nuclear energy. Now, there's a lot to be learned from this event, especially as it pertains to Japan's history, culture, and ability to create its own source of stable energy. So we're going to be talking about the criteria leading up to Japan's decision to move forward with nuclear, the dramatic impact on the business environment, as well as the social impact on its people. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Thomas Drillette. Good afternoon, Mr. Drillette, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, June. It's great to be back. Look forward to it.
Mr. Drillette, can you please tell our audience about your background? You have such a wonderful background, and I think for many people that are looking for credible information about this event, it's very important that people such as yourself who are experts on this subject are able to speak about all the things that we've learned, our culture, their culture, also from your own personal observations from visiting not only Fukushima, but Chernobyl.
Well, I've been in the energy business overall, June, for about 40 years. Right after graduation from postgrad school in England, I joined one of the biggest utilities and went up through their line in terms of operations at the coal-fired and nuclear-powered sites. I then got into management and did a variety of jobs, ending up in senior management in what was and still is North America's largest electrical utility, Ontario Hydro, since renamed Ontario Power Generation. I then worked with U.S. utilities, American Electric Power, DT Energy out of Detroit, and finally ended up in the last few years doing a geothermal energy or renewable energy project north of San Francisco in the Geysers, a 35-megawatt power plant there. And in amongst all of that, I've probably spent half my life on the road internationally doing work related to big energy systems, not just in Canada and the States, but around the world. I've been in far too many countries. I want to slow down, June.
I bet. That's a lot of traveling.
But it is. It is.
Your experience, especially with nuclear, you know, it's interesting when you talk to an expert such as yourself and you talk about not only the problems with nuclear, but also the reasons why different countries choose to move forward with nuclear. It's very interesting. It's not so clean cut as people would like to think. And the bottom line is that people are not ready or even willing to just stop all of the different resources that we use that do have a potential negative impact on the environment, in order to prevent any type of future disasters, what have you, they're not ready to just say, okay, well, you know what, until we come up with something, we're going to go back to living in the days where there was no electricity. People lived basically in a cave. And the bottom line is that we need to do something, but it's not going to happen overnight. So it's important that we look at where we've been and where we're going. And especially in Japan, where culture really does make a difference, there's a lot to be considered as far as their decision to even move forward into nuclear. So can you explain to our audience exactly why there were some hesitations with the Japanese government in order to even move forward into nuclear?
Well, June, it has to start way back in 1945 when two nuclear weapons were dropped on the country of Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in order to put into context that the Japanese people that are still alive today, since or born since that time, have that in their memory bank, have that in their school books, have had that drummed into them that, you know, nuclear power, as far as they were concerned, got a terrible start. So it led to a predisposition to not want any part of nuclear commercial power. And that was true throughout the 50s and early 60s. But then Japan, as it industrialized like crazy after the war, along with the Marshall Plan and everything else, it needed dense energy systems. I have to go back and also mention that Japan is one of the most people-dense countries in the world, 120, 130 million people in a very small landmass. So when you get that number of people, that number of industries working, you need energy systems that provide a dense energy capability. In other words, let me just paint a final picture. Solar, you'd have to cover, you know, half the mass of Japan and have it daylight all of the time in order to provide the energy. So they needed to look at dense energy systems, and they had a choice. They, of course, had the choice of gas and coal from around the world, predominantly on the gas side from the Middle East and Indonesia, and coal from Australia and different parts of North America and so forth. They made the choice reluctantly to go along with nuclear energy. And it was done because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and those memories. But they felt they had to proceed. So starting in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, they built up quite a cadre of nuclear power plants, 54 of them, by March of 2011 when the accident happened, providing 28% of all of their power. The rest mostly comes from imported liquefied natural gas, or what we know as natural gas, I'll just use that term, and coal-fired power with some geothermal. Given that they're on the Ring of Fire, they do have some deep heat sources which they've tapped, but very little other power sources. So that's how they got into the game, and it was a reluctant start.
Having said that, when they began to go into nuclear, what were some of the other criteria, especially when it came to looking at other countries for their sources for stable energy? Were there any conflicts as far as working with the Middle East? Were there any things of that nature, Tom?
Well, in terms of conflicts, I guess diversification, just like we think about with our own portfolios, if we have them in caring for our future sources of money, you want to put a diversified portfolio together of investments, and they wanted the diversified sources of energy. They didn't want to just rely on the Middle East. What if there's a major conflagration? They didn't want to just rely on nuclear power. What if there was, in fact, what happened, an accident? So they wanted a variety of sources. So given the Japanese tendency to always look for an industrial export ramification to what they're doing, they also developed around their nuclear system, since that's what we're talking about today, a wide variety of research institutes that looked at other forms of nuclear power, even the very advanced fast reactor systems. They developed their own radioactive waste management systems, and what I call the Japanese Inc., which is called Kiritsu in Japanese, or the industrial grouping of major companies, the Marubenis, the Fujis, the Toshibas. They all banded together and got the IP or intellectual property for a lot of the nuclear systems that they imported from the U.S., from France, and from other countries. And then they sort of Japanized a lot of that and built up their system. So what I'm trying to say is they took what they felt were the best technologies from others and built up their own industrial base to put it into place.
Can you explain to our audience exactly what happened back in March of last year and what you've noticed, I guess, as far as the differences between the initial disaster and what has taken place in Japan today?
Well, you have up on your site, the CleanTech View site, not just a picture of me, but a map of Japan. And if people are listening to this and that map comes up, I'll just try and draw a mind's eye picture. The nuclear power plants, because they need cooling, massive amounts of water for cooling the condensers, they have to be on the coastline. So all of those 54 reactors I mentioned were basically all on the coast surrounding the whole of Honshu Island, and in one case up in Hokkaido on the North Island as well, and a couple in a southern island down to the south. But they're all on the seaside. Now, the major fault line that joins the Pacific and the Asian plates runs just offshore of the northeast part of the main Honshu Island, roughly 100, 150 miles out. And this is a line where I believe the Pacific plate is slipping underneath the Asian plate. So that's what's leading to all the earthquakes that Japan and the whole Ring of Fire has, even on our side in Chile and the west coast of the U.S. So when the plate slipped, and it slipped massively, it led to the biggest single recorded earthquake, 9.0, some references say 9.1, but it doesn't matter. That's a logarithmic scale. That's a massive shift of Earth. In fact, the whole island of Japan, if you will, shifted something like a meter and a half to the west. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that led to this tsunami wave. So I have to get on the record, the cause of the nuclear disaster was initiated by nature, but then things went wrong. Mm-hmm. At the Fukushima Daiichi, you've got six reactors. Two of the reactors at the north end of the site, and by the way, the site is approximately a rectangular shape, about 2 miles long along the seaside, and about a half a mile inland. So you can sort of get an idea. It's a square mile of area. In the southern part of the site are the four reactors. They're all boiling water reactors of an early design by General Electric that was jointly built up by Japanese industry and General Electric of the U.S. That Mark I BWR design had two main failings, as the accident has shown in retrospect. Number one, the emergency power systems, which are used to provide electricity for the cooling pumps to keep the fuel cool, were down low below the seawall. And secondly, the spent fuel bays, where the used fuel from the reactors is put, was way up high in the design, near the top of the reactor buildings. Now, I have to mention those two things. Here's the sequence. So the wave of water, 43 feet tall, 18 feet higher than the seawall protecting the site, washed over the eastern edge of the site, if you will, drowned out the emergency power systems. So they were left only with battery systems, which kept the power on for a few hours. And then there was no electricity inside the main units. What happens then is the cooling pump stopped, the fuel started to heat up, and what caused the main problem that we all saw on the TV so many times, the explosions, is that when water boils around the ever-increasing heat, hot fuel that was getting hotter because it wasn't being cooled, so the still water was there, it disassociated into oxygen and hydrogen. And then in certain percentages between oxygen and hydrogen mixtures, you get an explosive mixture. So what you saw was a conventional chemical gas explosion basically wreck three units almost totally, and the fourth unit, the one furthest north, was slightly damaged. The two that I described initially at the very north side of the site were not harmed at all. Anyway, that's how the accident happened. But those hydrogen explosions, which happened on, from memory, days 2, 3, and 4, they were the main culprit that then dispersed some of the broken fuel particulate matter and radioactive gases, which are inside the fuel pins, which were now damaged, into the air and subsequently into the exclusion zone inland, and deposited as particulate matter. That's the long-term worry. And in the short term, the gaseous radioactive gases like xenons and cesiums, those sorts of gases, they were a transitory but very difficult situation to deal with, because you inhale a gas and therefore you get deposition of radioactivity inside your lungs and your body. So the Japanese government, somewhat slowly, I might say, made the decision to get the people out of that exclusion zone. There was a big debate, as we all know, about how big that exclusion zone should be. The people who were most fearful, as the public, said, my goodness, should we even evacuate Tokyo? But finally, between TEPCO, the utility that this happened to, that owned the Fukushima Daiichi site, and the government, they decided roughly, and I'm being rough here, an 18-kilometer or 12-mile semicircular exclusion zone was adequate. And in truth, the major part of the particulate and gaseous activity from the site drifted, because of the way the winds blew at that time, from the southeast to the northwest. So the major contamination of ground is in a ever-increasing cone width from the site to the northwest inland. That's what actually happened.
Just out of curiosity, when the disaster at Chernobyl happened, what was the impact? I mean, how much did the disaster affect as far as the the surrounding area? How many miles are we talking about?
Well, I got to the Chernobyl area about 5 days after the accident, when it was still in a firefighting and snuffing of the critical reaction still going on in Unit 4 Core. So it was still smoldering, if you will, but coincidentally, the winds at that time were from the southeast. In other words, coming from Kiev and drifting to the northwest. So most of the plume of radioactivity sort of went up fairly high because the explosion force in Chernobyl was far, far more, blew the lid right off Unit 4. It was just a pile of rubble. And then over Belarus and eventually over Poland and over Scandinavia and, of course, around the globe. But by the time it got to the west coast of the U.S., was pretty small. But in a direct answer to your question, the land to the northwest of Chernobyl Unit 4 was severely contaminated in comparison to anything that happened at Fukushima Daiichi, and then was less and less. The only good news I can say about Chernobyl is the initial blast was so strong and so powerful that a lot of it went up into the air, into the stratosphere almost, and got carried by the jet stream around the globe. So the dispersion was far greater in distance, and the amount deposited, except for the immediate area, say a 20-kilometer radius around Chernobyl, was a lot less. So it's just the way the vagaries of the explosion and the winds were at the time.
Once a disaster such as this occurs, can you even clean up the environment?
You can. You can. We've done it in various small research reactor experiments that went wrong here in the States and Canada. Soil can be decontaminated. Foliage can be removed and buried. So my simple answer is time, of course, helps to heal. It's not thousands of years. It turns out that you can basically get the major activity scraped off of the ground, the contamination, and the foliage taken off such that sites like at Hanford and Idaho Falls in the States, and I can give you a Canadian example, the NRU reactor at or NRX reactor at Chalk River, those cleanups happened over years, not centuries. So yes, my answer is they can and are going to clean up the exclusion zone. It will be a government public decision as to whether people actually move back in there someday or not. I won't comment on that. I was not involved in that. But the Japanese will have a decision to make 5-10 years down the road whether they want to come back into the exclusion zone or declare it to be, and I'm picking these words out of the air, some sort of a national memorial park.
Okay. Interesting. Now, my next question to you is, for the people that were exposed to the radiation, do you have any idea even how many people were exposed and any of the steps that the government is taking to, help others avoid contamination or further contamination, might I add?
Sure. I can give you a couple of personal examples in a moment of things that I observed, but generally speaking, if you are, as an individual, caught in a contamination wind, if you will, and there is radioactivity, mild radioactivity deposited on you, there are tried and true in the nuclear industry ways of decontaminating your hands. You use pumice soap. You shower a lot. They collect, of course, all of the water and process it and filter and purify it. You can put permanganate solutions on your skin, which will take off all of the superficial contamination. Inhalation, of course, you can't do anything about, but the radioactive gases that are in the air tend, other than the cesiums, to be relatively short-lived, so don't have a high residence time in the body because they do decay away. But the real fear initially was from the gases rather than the contamination. The contamination can be washed off, and those that were cleaned up by the system, if you will. But I've got a couple of observations about things that I noticed over there. For instance, when you go into a shop and you see a man and a woman shopping for vegetables or anything that's outside of a can or a box, they've got little Geiger counters. People have gone and bought little retail Geiger counters that they check the lettuce or tomatoes or whatever it is they happen to be buying. And that's just become a way of life since the accident through sheer public fear of the contamination of the food chain. Secondly, I remember being invited to a dinner party one night, and the lady of the house, as I came in, greeted me warmly, but she greeted me with a Geiger counter and sort of swished me over to make sure I wasn't glowing. And, of course, I wasn't. But it's just things you see. In their business offices, they're more informal in their attire because they've had to turn up the air conditioning because of a lack of electricity. So gone is the tie and suit type of environment that I always knew over the last 20 years in Japan. Now it's like informal dress down Fridays in Tokyo.
That's a big culture change.
It is. It's a real big culture change. And at other things, the Ginza at night, the very famous area that's the sort of entertainment district, which, of course, I would never go into, but I'm just kidding. The lights are out at night. They're conservation techniques in Japan, the most advanced conservation techniques and energy efficiency technologies are applied in Japan. Thank God. They have that. We have a lot to learn in North America about how advanced, how much less electricity you can use if you really put your mind to it. And they have done a lot of that, and they've had to do it because of this accident.
It just makes you wonder at what point here in North America do we have to reach in order to learn what the Japanese are already implementing. I mean, the fact that we waste so much energy, it's ridiculous. And furthermore, the fact that we know that we need to eliminate the dependency on fossil fuels, but yet it almost seems as though when it runs out, that's when people are going to take action. But,
unfortunately, June, it's an old truism about man or people kind. We don't change until a crisis happens. We tend to motor on and do the same old stuff until a crisis happens, and then we wake up someday and say, whoops, we better change. We're seeing it in Europe now, economically. But really it leads to this final point about what are they going to do in the future? Oh, my goodness. They're starting slowly to bring a few of their nuclear reactors back. Kansai Electric in the Northeast has announced that with the permission of the governments, local and federal, they're going to bring back the Ohio units over the next couple of months. I predict that up to 20 to 25 units over the next year, year and a half will come back out of sheer necessity. Otherwise, Japanese industry will start to lose a lot of business. And I think they're a very practical people, and even though the public is angered beyond belief, I can only say that really strongly, the public is very upset about this necessity, national necessity, to bring back some of the nukes. And that will play a lot in our newspapers in the next little while. So all I've got left is to replace that with more LNG, liquefied natural gas, and natural gas-fired stations, and coal stations, and I do believe they're going to tap the rest of their geothermal renewable energy and do some solar. But the preponderance of the black hole of a lack of electricity will come from gas and coal. So back to the fossil era, predominantly, to fill in the void.
We have a question from the audience. Basically, it's our audience member would like to know, what happened to cold fusion?
I was involved in fusion for a little bit, in fact, in the Canadian Fusion Program when cold fusion came up. The short answer, I know we're short of time, is that cold fusion was thought to be a sham at the time by Fleshman and Pons, but there was an energy release reaction. It's thought today that it is predominantly an electrochemical reaction rather than a fusion of deuterium atoms, which would release massive amounts of energy like in our sun. So cold fusion, or better, electrochemical fusion, is being pursued in many laboratories. I don't think the game is over. I believe we'll one day hear that we do have another energy system, but it won't. I don't think it will be fusion as it was thought to be at that time.
Thank you. In regards to the future of nuclear, do you think that any future plants that are built have incorporated not only the previous disasters, but are taking other elements that we haven't even considered into consideration before they even move forward? I mean, are they really thinking this through?
June, they have to. If they don't, then the industry deserves the demise that will come upon it. They have to stop having these types of accidents. And yes, they are diligently, I can tell you from discussions with a lot of them, looking at the accident, trying to learn all of the lessons, going for more modularly built, passively safe systems that are inherently more safe. They have, I don't want to get technical too much here, but they have negative reactivity coefficients. In other words, when something goes wrong, they actually want to shut down. And they are passively cooled because you thermosiphon the coolant water. You don't need the pump to keep the fuel cool. These are all lessons that the industry is learning and applying in the Generation 3 Plus reactors and the Generation 4 Plus designs that are on the drawing boards of today. But my bottom line is they have to learn it. Otherwise, nuclear power will not be in our future. And we desperately need strong, big, baseload power systems to keep our industrialized societies going.
Just out of curiosity, what is Japan currently relying upon for its energy?
It was, of course, 28% nuke, but let's just take that down to zero for the moment. Right now, it's mostly liquefied natural gas, which is then put back after it's shipped from the Middle East or Indonesia or different parts of the world into gas form, piped to combined cycle gas turbine plants, conventional natural gas-fired plants and generate electricity, coal plants, hydroelectric plants, and, like I say, a bit of geothermal. I can't remember the exact split, but my gut says 40% LNG, 30% coal, about 20% hydroelectric, and then an eclectic version of, you know, mixture of solar, geothermal, wind, and burning garbage waste in making electricity from that, et cetera.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, you've been to Fukushima a year ago shortly after the disaster occurred, and recently you just visited the site. Where do you see Japan going a year from now?
I see a year from now something like 15 of the reactors back and running, the ones that are furthest away from the faults, after a lot of safety changes. I see a lot more LNG fired or natural gas fired combined cycle gas turbines. I see a few more coal fired plants. I see a few more geothermal plants being built. They take some 5 years because of all the drilling. So I see them coming back slowly, but generally speaking, the main fuel source, new one, will be more and more natural gas.
Do you think that with regards to natural gas, that's going to be their primary source of energy until they either build another nuclear plant or find some other technology that they're going to depend upon?
I think for the time being, their policy debates within the government and industry revolve mostly around natural gas for the foreseeable future. I do not see them building any new nuclear power plants. It's almost goes without saying that the public would probably march in the streets if industry decided to do that. In fact, I see Toshiba, Marubeni, Fuji looking for export markets in the Middle East. I mean, Saudi and UAE, Jordan. These places have all decided to get into the nuclear power business. And it's Japanese industry that said, well, since we can't build more nukes at home, let's go try our hand offshore. And that's where they're focused today.
Very interesting. Mr. Jarrell, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's always interesting talking to you, especially since you've been to both sites and, I mean, shortly after the disasters have occurred and have been there since, and just the different observations that you have as well as your experiences. It's just tremendous hearing this firsthand.
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about some of it. There's always lots more to talk about, but I do hope personally, as a personal wish, that that nuclear power gets its act straight and provides that base load component of power in the longer term, because when it's done safely, it is a clean source of energy and an abundant source of energy. We've got lots of uranium in the world, and we've got even more thorium, should we ever get into a thorium fuel cycle for the longer term on the nuclear side.
Very interesting. Once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. Can you tell our audience how they can reach out to you, and also if you have any upcoming events that you're going to be speaking at?
Oh, yes. I've got a website, which is just the three W's, dot, and then my name, DroletEnergy.com, so D-R-O-L-E-T, energy.com. That's a website, and it mostly gives PDFs of all my talks that I give and a couple of articles I've written, that sort of thing. The next major speaking events are one at the Money Show in Chicago. That comes in October. September up in New York with the Murdoch Capital Partners people. And finally, in September, I might have the date wrong, but it might be October as well, I'm speaking at Cambridge House International's big investment conference in Toronto, Canada. Those are the next three.
And then the Clean Energy Symposium with Murdoch Capital on October 30th.
How dare I forget that? The day before Halloween, that's right. I look forward to that, June. I really do.
Well, I look forward to seeing you there, as I will be there as a co-host, and it will be quite an event. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been wonderful having you. Once again, thank you for just all the insight and information that you don't really hear from mainstream media. You really have to talk to somebody or read a book that's written by somebody such as yourself, who has actually been to the site and can talk about not only the problems, but the solutions. So thank you once again.
Well, thank you, June, and one day I must get to that book. Have a good day.
Okay. Thank you, folks, for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon.